The day before Thanksgiving in 1971, a nondescript man in his 30s or 40s boarded a flight in Portland, Oregon to go to Seattle, Washington, thus starting one of the craziest and to this day only unsolved cases of air piracy in the United States history. This is a story of D.B. Cooper and the hijacking of Flight 305. My name is Brett Bilesville. Welcome back to the Curiosity Chronicles. I'm your host. Glad you're here with me. Let's dive into this and talk about what I was curious about this month. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. 1971, November 24, 1971, the day before Thanksgiving, as I said, a man by the name of Dan Cooper purchases a ticket on Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305. He is in Portland, Oregon. The flight is heading to Seattle, Washington. He's described as nondescript, so not described at all, I guess. He's a white man, possibly in his 40s. In business attire. He's got a suit and a tie. The tie is a clip-on, which is important to know later. He waits around, boards the flight, and orders a bourbon and soda, chain-smoking cigarettes in his seat until the flight takes off. Very shortly after takeoff, or even possibly right before takeoff, depending on the source that you read, he hands a note to the stewardess. Now, keep in mind, this is 1971. Stewardesses were the hot job for women, and then hot being the operative word. They were glamorous. They were usually very attractive. They were young. In fact, the stewardess that he handed the note to in an interview many years later said that if she was to get pregnant, she would have lost her job. It's a very different time. But stewardess needed to be desirable. And so when she's handed the note, she is assuming that this gentleman is hitting on her, this Dan Cooper. So she doesn't read the note. She's busy getting the flight started, doing all the services that need to be done. So she waits, sticks it in her pocket. Cooper gets her attention. Says, Miss, I really think you should read that note. Paraphrasing, of course. So she opens the note, and in the note, he informs her that he has a bomb and that he would like her to sit next to him. So very calmly and professionally, even though she was terrified, she sits next to Dan Cooper, and he shows her what's in his briefcase. And what she can see is a mass of wires and red-colored sticks that had the appearance of dynamite. It's a very dangerous situation. The stewardess, at that point, is given the opportunity to inform the pilots. Now, keep in mind, this is pre-9/11 by 30 years. There is no security at these airports. You bought a ticket, you walked out on the tarmac, and you walked up the staircase into the door. They did not check luggage or anything. And at the time, most hijackings were, this is almost pre-terrorist days, at least how we would understand it. So hijackings at this time were a lot of times Cuban nationals that were trying to get back to Cuba. In one of the interviews that I saw, it was actually a pilot that had been hijacked by Cuban nationals. He said they land in Cuba, they have a good time, and everybody kind of has a Cuban nightlife. They get back on the plane, they fly home, and it's kind of a happy memory, even though it's terrifying for a few minutes. So the access to the cockpit was much more open than it is nowadays. The cockpit's not locked. This was not something that was a major concern to airlines. Hijacking was not the incredibly devastating terrorist events that we, of course, know now from September 11, and even before that, when Islamic radicals were hijacking different planes. So it's a different time, so you have to keep that in mind during this story. But the stewardess is allowed to go up to the front of the plane. She goes right into the cockpit, as is her, she's allowed to, it's unlocked. She informs the pilots that there's a man with what appears to be a bomb, and he is hijacking the plane. The pilots contact air traffic control in Seattle, and the air traffic control contacts Seattle police, who then contact the FBI. FBI is in charge of investigating hijackings, or air piracy, as it's called. So the FBI calls the airline pilot, Northwest Airline President Donald Nyrop, I think is how you pronounce his name. And Nyrop tells them to comply. Give Cooper what he wants. And this is when the story gets really crazy. This is like, I cannot believe this has not been made into a movie. I watched a documentary, but I want to see like a movie on this. Cooper tells the authorities that he wants $200,000 in cash. And he is smart about how he requests it. Because first off, he requests it in $20 bills. $20 bills are big enough denomination that you can easily transport $200,000. But it's not a large enough denomination that makes it hard to spend or launder. So $20 bills, $200,000 in cash. You also ask for non-serialized serial numbers, or non-sequential serial numbers, excuse me. Non-sequential serial numbers, so that they'd be harder to track. But then he also demands two sets of parachutes, so four total parachutes. This guy had a plan. This guy had a really good plan. So he makes those demands. He says, I want those items, $200,000 in cash and four parachutes, when we land in Seattle. Which they do. They safely land. Everybody's staying calm. In fact, most of the, I believe there's 36 other passengers on the plane, not one of them at that point had any idea that they had actually been hijacked. They just were on their flight. Everybody that was in charge was calm, cool, and collected. They were working with Cooper. Cooper, aside from the chain smoking, was reported to be quite calm and not frantic. He seemed to have a plan and knew exactly what he was doing. And so they land in Seattle. The authorities convince Cooper to let the other passengers get off the plane. So the 36 passengers leave the plane, and they, after a period of time, it took some time, especially to get the $200,000 and these parachutes. I mean, not parachutes aren't just laying around. You got to grab them from somewhere. So after waiting there for a bit, the authorities give him the $200,000 in cash and the four parachutes, and the plane takes off again. Now it's just the pilot, the co-pilot, the stewardesses. I don't know if all the stewardesses or just the one that he was originally working with. That was not clear to me. But basically, it's the crew for piloting the plane and the crew for, quote-unquote, the customer service of the plane, and Cooper. And that is who's left on the plane. So the plane gets some more fuel, and passengers are off. Cooper orders the plane to take off and head in the direction of Mexico City. And besides that, he also orders the pilot to stay below 10,000 feet and under 150 knots in speed, which works out to about 173 miles per hour. He then orders the cabin to be depressurized. Now, this is all important information because we know that he has the parachutes. First off, a human can breathe at 10,000 feet. There are mountains that are in Colorado that are, 14,000 feet, and people climb them, no problem. So still breathe at 10,000 feet, which means if the cabin is depressurized, Cooper doesn't have to worry about suffocating, but also means that when he opens a door, there's not going to be the intense depressurization that's going to suck him right out the door. So he's thought ahead. He's planned this out clearly. He knows what he's doing. So the pilots and the stewardess, they've left him alone. Cooper is by himself in the back of the plane, the aft portion of the plane. And the pilots get a notification when the door is opened. And they're in communication with Cooper through the intraplane phone system, intercom, so to speak. So they try to raise him on that after they get the notice that the door is open. They don't get any response back. So they, I don't remember if they landed or if someone checked it out before they landed. But long story short, shortly after 8 p.m., Cooper, with the money, opened the door and jumped out of the plane. He's never been seen again. At least not knowingly. Such an insane story. Hijacked a plane with a bomb, ransomed it for money, jumped out into the night, never seen again. So what happened? What happened to D.B. Cooper? So what we know for sure, so here are the facts. We know for sure that somewhere between Seattle, Washington and Reno, Nevada, Cooper jumped out of the plane. And based on the pilot's best recollection, he jumped out somewhere in Washington over a fairly wild part of the Washington geography. It was roughly around 8 p.m. And we know for sure that he was never seen again. The FBI investigated it and have never been able to determine who Dan Cooper was. The case was basically closed in 2016. The FBI announced that they would no longer be allocating resources to the investigation of the hijacking of Flight 305. They did run a bunch of names through the databases to see if they got any hits. They did get a hit on a man named D.B. Cooper, who had a criminal record, but he was quickly ruled out as a suspect. However, a reporter saw the news story or saw the name pop up in a flash, and he put it out there irresponsibly, saying D.B. Cooper was the hijacker, which was wrong, of course, and was retracted. But from then on, that story kind of exploded throughout the wire service. And despite the fact that Dan Cooper used the name Dan Cooper throughout the entire hijacking event, because of that one reporter's irresponsibility, this whole case has become known as the D.B. Cooper case. So that explains a little bit why I've been referring to him as Dan Cooper when history, quote-unquote, knows him as D.B. Cooper. But those are the facts. That is what is for sure known. The best guess as to what has happened is that Cooper did not survive. There was, at first, there was the belief that Dan Cooper was somehow experienced in skydiving or jumping out of airplanes, maybe from a military career or just a recreational career. But as the investigation proceeded, it became more and more clear that Cooper was not an experienced parachutist, from the best evidence that was available to the investigators at the time. The weather was incredibly poor when Cooper jumped. One of the reasons they think he was inexperienced is because no experienced parachutist would have jumped out into weather like that. And not only that, the area that he jumped over was extremely rugged. As best as they can tell, he was jumping into mountainous, forested area. Again, no experienced parachutist would have jumped into that area. The parachutes that he had, they did not have the ability to steer, so it's not like he could steer for a landing zone. It was basically you jump and you parachute and you land wherever the wind takes you. Put all those factors together, and the leading theory is that Cooper died after he jumped out of the plane. And a body was never found. hence the reason that this can only be a guess. The body has never been found and identified, and for the most part, the money has not been found. There's really no physical evidence one way or the other. And so it can't be ruled out that he survived. But it's also not as big of a problem for investigators who believe that he did die that the body hasn't been found. Because like I said, he jumped into an extremely rugged and difficult to traverse geographical area. So it would be very difficult to find a body in that area, especially since the area they would have to search is quite large. It's not an exact location. I read that in the same general area, a pilot in a single engine plane, just the pilot in the plane, crashed, and they didn't find the wreckage for like 40 or 60 years. It finally popped up. Someone kind of stumbled on it by accident. And that's a plane. This is just one body and a parachute. So that's the leading theory. In 1980, so 9 years after the hijacking occurred, an 8-year-old boy found a bundle of cash in $20 bills that matched the serial numbers given to D.B. Cooper, Dan Cooper. This has led investigators, both amateur and professional, to believe that Cooper survived the jump. The money was about $5,800, if I remember correctly. And in the area that he landed, so allegedly, the money was not quite in that area. It was in a different area of Washington. So the belief was that he must have survived, because how would the money get from where he landed to where it was found in 1980? There was searches of the area where the money was found, but unfortunately, later in 1980, an eruption of Mount St. Helens destroyed any evidence that could or had been in that area before it could have been found if it existed. So just bad luck for the investigators in that. But because of the fact that no body has ever been found, and because these bills were found, for sure the bills that were given to Cooper, that's not in dispute, the serial numbers matched, but they weren't found in the exact spot where they quote-unquote should have been found if he didn't survive, has led many people to investigate this for many years and come up with different theories on who D.B. Cooper may have been. And that's what I want to spend some time on, is nothing concrete, but what's the best guess of who Dan Cooper was? So if you were to do a Google search on this, there's like 50 names you might find in 20 different articles. I obviously don't have time to go over through all of those. And for the most part, a lot of them are fairly ridiculous or easily debunked. But there are a few that we'll see. I mean, I don't think anybody will ever know. But I picked the ones that I felt were most likely to be Dan Cooper, and then I'll kind of give my personal take on it, with the full disclosure that I'm a complete and utter amateur. I'm really just going on my gut instinct as an educated adult. I have no background in investigation or criminal justice, nothing like that. It just basically going off my gut and what I think as a rational adult. So who was D.B. Cooper? First likely suspect, so to speak, a man by the name of Dwayne Weber. He passed away in 1995, but before he passed away, he had been married for, I believe, 17 years to a woman named Jo Weber. And he was in his 70s, I believe, by the time he passed away. And on his deathbed, in fact, basically his last words, he called his wife over, Joe. He says that he had a secret, and his deathbed confession was, "I am Dan Cooper." And then he died. Very dramatic. If that's true, that is one heck of a way to go out. Boom, bombshell, dead. That is a deathbed confession if I ever heard one. So Joe Weber started digging into the past of her husband, Dwayne. And she started to see connections. For example, Weber was a chain smoker. Dan Cooper was a chain smoker. They smoked the same brand, supposedly. Weber was a bourbon drinker. Again, it appeared that they drank the same bourbon. Dan Cooper and Dwayne Weber, drank the same bourbon. Weber had a military record, so he was trained in military tactics, but it's unclear whether that included skydiving, parachuting, you know, paratrooper type training, but it's possible. And he also had a criminal record. Once a criminal, not always a criminal. I mean, I don't mean that there's rehabilitation, of course, but the first place the FBI looked for Dan Cooper was in criminal databases, past criminals. So, someone with a criminal record, possibly more likely to commit a criminal act again. And then there was some odd things, like the license that she found in Dwayne Weber's wallet after he died that had a completely different last name of Collins. It started to become apparent that Dwayne Weber was a bit of a con man, and he had different aliases. So was one of those aliases Dan Cooper? That's what he said. Before he died, Dwayne took Joe Weber on a trip to the Pacific Northwest. And according to Joe, they were driving on the highway. He stopped, pointed at the trees, and said, "This is where Dan Cooper walked out of the woods." I'll give my take at the end, I suppose. I was gonna say something, but I'll wait till the end. And then they were staying at a hotel, and Dwayne left for a period of time, came back, and he was dirty, like he'd been digging. And then later, Joe said he threw a bag of trash, or what he said was trash, into the river. And she remembers it very distinctly because, according to her, she was raised in a family that was horrendously anti-litter. And so she was horrified that he would throw this bag of trash into the river. That bag, she now suspects, based on where they were when he put it in the river and where that 8-year-old boy found money, she believes that instead of a bag of trash, he went to where he hid the money, dug up about $5,800 of it, put it in that bag, and then I'm not sure why, maybe to retrieve it later, he threw it in the river, because then based on how the river flows and the patterns of the current, it could have washed up right at the spot on the Columbia River where that 8-year-old boy found the money. So that's her theory. She never saw money, though. I want you to keep that in mind. But she believes that he threw the money in the river, and that was the money that the boy found in 1980. On top of all that, Dwayne Weber somewhat matches the composite sketch that was done of Dan Cooper from the recollections of all the people that saw him on the plane. Now, I want to say that, but it is also a very generic sketch. So, somewhat matching this composite sketch is not strong evidence. Like, I don't think it would have been used in court, because I don't think it would have held up. But there is some resemblance. Now, my take on this is, it's all hearsay. All of this is Joe Weber saying, Dwayne said this, Dwayne said that. there's not really any corroborating evidence. There's nothing physical to tie Dwayne Weber to this hijacking. Like Joe says, one time I saw a airline ticket for a Northwest Orient Airlines flight, and I asked Dwayne about it, and it mysteriously disappeared, and I never saw the ticket again. But nobody else saw that ticket. There's nothing to back up her story. It's all hearsay. No physical evidence or any evidence that she claims was there mysteriously disappeared before anybody else could see it. So it doesn't hold water to me. Hearsay does not hold up in court. It's not something used as strong evidence by investigators. And I just can't, until she has firm proof other than her words, I'm not calling her a liar, but I'm not calling her a reliable source either. Now, beyond that, you might, if you research this a little bit more, you might hear stories about how the FBI bungled the investigation. They'll be articles that say things like, oh, can you believe that they lost the cigarette butts that Cooper smoked? Which I'm not sure why that has become a thing. You see interviews, people even said it in a documentary I watched. It's not true. I mean, they have that evidence. And so the biggest thing, and what I think is the only evidence that needs to be talked about, even though I did talk about other things, is that it wasn't announced right away, but before Cooper jumped out of the plane, he took off his necktie, his clip-on necktie, and through that and maybe the cigarette butts as well, as technology increased, the FBI was able to get materials off of the necktie, especially that allowed them to test DNA. And so when they tested Weber's DNA against the DNA on the necktie and fingerprints from Cooper's cigarettes, they ruled Weber out. Did not match. And that's all I need to know, because DNA evidence doesn't lie. So my take is that Dwayne Weber is not Dan Cooper. And I can say that fairly confidently because the FBI says the same thing. So let's move on to the next one. And this is the... this one makes me laugh. It shouldn't. I don't know. It's. I mean, you'll see what I mean. Because the next candidate to be Dan Cooper is Barbara Dayton. And if there's one thing that all the people that saw Dan Cooper agreed on, that was he was a man. That is one thing they all agreed on. And so was Barbara Dayton until 1969. She was born Robert or Bob Dayton. And had, I think, if I remember correctly, I didn't write it down, but had some experience in the Army and applied to Johns Hopkins, the hospital, to, in 1969, have gender reassignment surgery. She felt that she was trapped in a man's body. He or she was trapped in a man's body. She was denied, and so she went to Seattle and was granted the request. So in 1969, he, Robert, had gender reassignment surgery and became she, Barbara Dayton. You'll notice 1969, that's 2 years before the hijacking. But all of her friends, his friends, I don't know how to... I don't want to be politically incorrect, but... I mean, he was a guy, and then he was a woman. I don't know. Okay. I'm just going to say whatever comes into my head as I'm talking, and don't crucify me. This person was a daring but also very skilled pilot, a parachutist, and someone that kind of lived on the edge. You know, she did have experience jumping out of airplanes, but she was denied a commercial pilot's license. If I remember correctly, it was the test. She couldn't pass the test. But he felt that it was unfair that she was denied a pilot's license. She had some friends. There were neighbors and people that also hung around the airport that she flew at recreationally, called the Foremans. They were a married couple. And they would hang out socially at the Foreman's house with other groups of friends. And at some point, as all pilots apparently in the Seattle area do, they started talking about D.B. Cooper. And they had a picture. And just as friends do, the conversation kind of devolved. And someone said something about how Barbara Dayton kind of looked like D.B. Cooper. And so they took the composite sketch, which, if you see it, sometimes has Cooper wearing sunglasses, and they kind of did Barbara's hair and put sunglasses on her, and then they took a Polaroid of it. And this is where the story kind of lost me, because according to the Foremans, when they took the Polaroid and it immediately developed, it was such an uncanny resemblance that one of the other couples at the party basically screamed in fright because, oh, we're accessories to the crime, grabbed the picture and tore it up. That seems ridiculous to me. Like, why? Why? At that point, I was like, ah, okay, this story, I don't believe it. And it doesn't hold water for me. Apparently, according to the Foremans, who wrote a book, interestingly enough, and made money from it, which is an important thing to consider, after this picture incident and some more hanging out time, Barbara Dayton confessed to them that she was, in fact, Dan Cooper, and that she disguised herself as a man and used the mannerisms that she knew because she used to be a man to hijack the plane, and then when she jumped out of the plane, she again took off her disguise, became a woman, and that's how she got away with it. You know, she was a woman, everybody was looking for a man. No, I don't believe it. I don't believe it for a second. Even if she was disguised as a man, even if she had done this hijacking before her surgery, which wasn't, but even if, like, she didn't fit the description. She was different height, different eye color, different haircut. It didn't fit. So the whole story about them taking a picture and matching it with a composite sketch is just bullshit. But they wrote a book and sold the book and made a lot of money. I feel bad. In the interviews, they seem like genuinely nice people. And they seemed like very believable. But I'm calling BS on their whole story. And it's all hearsay. There's not any physical evidence one way or the other that connects Barbara Dayton with this crime. It's complete hearsay from one couple that I deem to be highly unreliable despite my amateur status. And the FBI agrees with me. I should say I agree with the FBI. They have ruled her out as a suspect. Next suspect that people suspect is a man named L.D. Cooper. Right off the bat, I'm just like, don't believe in this one, because what moron would use an alias but only change the first name? You're like, oh, I want to get away with this. Can't call me L.D., just call me Dan, but you can still use my last name. So, not off to a strong start with that one. But the story behind L.D. Cooper comes from his niece, Marla. Now, keep in mind, in 1971, Marla was 8 years old, so super reliable source. And according to her, the day before the hijacking occurred, she was with her uncle LD and LD's brother, her other uncle. I can't recall his name. But she was related to them because, as uncles, they were her dad's brothers. and she was with them, and she said they were acting mysterious, like they were plotting something. Okay. I picked these because they seemed like the more likely stories, and they are the ones that get a lot of coverage, but like as I'm saying it out loud, I'm like, this is ridiculous. What a bunch of BS. Anyway, I'll try. Okay. I'll be, you know, professional and just give you the facts. So she said they were being conspiratorial, and they were kind of joking around with her. Like, she kept asking them what they were talking about, and they were like, ah, we're going turkey hunting because it's Thanksgiving, you know, and she kind of knew that something was up, but she couldn't get the truth out of them, and they kept just talking about a turkey hunt. And she was like, great, I mean, Thanksgiving, I love a turkey. And then the next day, the plane was hijacked. And according to her, LD showed up at her house that night to talk with her dad, and he was bloody, bruised, banged up, and he was claimed that he was in a car accident. And Marla's dad told Marla, go inside, you shouldn't be a part of this. But then before she left, even though they said, don't be a part of this, get out of here, LD says, we did it, we hijacked it, our money problems are over. Don't let Marla hear, but then say it immediately after, you know, you show. It's just, again, it's a bunch of BS, I think. And that's my take. You know, it's an unreliable source. She was 8 years old, and there's no real evidence other than, there's no evidence other than Marla's testimony. And from the interviews, and this isn't just from me, other articles have said this as well, Marla seems more interested in seeking fame than really any of the truth about the Dan Cooper story. And she's used that to get interviews on HBO documentaries and different articles on the web, and I'm talking about her right now, so obviously she's had a modicum of success. And then, of course, again, just like Dwayne Weber, LD's DNA was tested against Dan Cooper's DNA from the tie, and it did not match. So these are the things that boggle my mind. Like, people still talk consistently about Dwayne Weber and LD Cooper being Dan Cooper, but the DNA does not match. And it's not like people are talking about it being some conspiracy or some cover-up that, oh, the FBI screwed up and they don't want anybody to know. I don't know if people know. It's like, do the research. It doesn't match. This guy did not do it. Anyway. Next up. Last one, actually. And this one, to me, is the most probable if Cooper survived. This is a man named Richard Floyd McCoy. Now, Richard Floyd McCoy was a decorated Green Beret in Vietnam. And, I mean, Green Beret, a special ops. They would be trained in parachuting. You know, they're paratroopers. They would be trained in survival in harsh conditions. They would be trained in basically how to survive. And he... If this is true, this guy has got the biggest cojones of any criminal in the United States history, I think. Because the reason Richard Floyd McCoy, is considered a suspect in this is because he hijacked a plane on April 7, 1972. So 5-6 months after the Cooper plane was hijacked, McCoy hijacked a plane. And the MO was very similar to Cooper. He didn't use a bomb. He had a hand grenade and a pistol. And he gave a note, just like Cooper, to the stewardess. The note included the pin from the hand grenade, which is a badass move for a criminal. Like, I have a live hand grenade in my hand. Do what I say. So gives a note to the stewardess. Demands 4 parachutes. But this time, $500,000 in cash, not $200,000. $500,000 in cash, $500,000. And then after, again, landing, getting what he demanded, and having the plane take off again, he bailed out. I mean, boy, that's, if it worked the first time, maybe it'll work again, is kind of the theory behind if the people that think that McCoy is Cooper. And he may have gotten away with it. McCoy may have gotten away with it, but there was an old Army buddy that McCoy apparently used to talk to about hijacking a plane. And when they talked about it when they were in the Army, they talked about it as like a exercise in special operations. You know, this is how I would do it, blah, 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 blah. And he didn't think anything would come of it. But then when he saw this happen, he was like, uh-oh, that may have been McCoy. So he called the FBI and left a tip. And McCoy was arrested, and they found, like, I think $499,980 in his house. So, like, he had taken a $20 bill out of the cash, but basically all the other cash was there. So he was arrested and imprisoned. This one seems the most likely. My take on this one seems the most likely for obvious reasons. There's, again, not really any physical evidence, but this isn't hearsay of like a family member or a friend who's saying, oh, this one told me that this one was, you know, so-and-so told me that so-and-so was Dan Cooper. Like, I mean, this is, nobody's saying it, but boy, they did like the exact same thing. But it could also be a copycat. You know, it could very easily be a copycat. It's hard to say. One thing that I another, you know, little factor in here that kind of leads me to think, maybe it's possible. Another thing that I have not mentioned is that along with the tie that Cooper left on the plane, there was a tie pin. And from what I read, it was a tie pin that was common to a pin that students at Brigham Young University, BYU, used to wear. McCoy went to BYU for a time before he was in the Army. And there has not been any DNA evidence that can fully exclude McCoy as a suspect. But the problem with that is it's not because they haven't found that it hasn't matched. It's because McCoy's family will not give the FBI, or would not at the time, give the FBI any DNA from McCoy to match. McCoy died shortly after he was in prison. He was shot when he tried to escape. Shot and killed in 72 or 73. I don't remember the dates exactly, but it was in the 70s, trying to escape from prison, he was shot. But his family will not give the DNA evidence to the FBI in order to match it. So we can't preclude McCoy based on DNA evidence. McCoy has an alibi for the hijacking of the Cooper plane. Obviously, he was in prison and convicted of the second one, but he has an alibi for the Cooper hijacking, and his family testified that he was at dinner with them. You know, they were having an early Thanksgiving party, basically. But in my mind, if the family won't cooperate with the FBI to give them DNA testing to rule out McCoy, who's to say that they did not lie about the alibi? You know, it seems like they're kind of covering for something, because if it wasn't, if he truly had an alibi and the family knows for sure that McCoy did not do the hijacking of the Cooper flight, why not just give him the evidence and rule him out? Now, I could be just totally sensationalizing this and reading way too into it. Maybe they just want to be done with it. You know, he hijacked a plane. He was a criminal. He got killed. It's in the past. Like, let's just forget about it. But I don't know. It just, for me, I'm not saying it was McCoy, but if it was someone that survived, McCoy to me is by far the most likely candidate and never was able to be fully ruled out like the other candidates were. But gun to my head, if you guys say, tell me what you think happened. I don't think Cooper survived. I think Cooper died. It's not the dramatic end, fun. I mean, it's a criminal act, but it's not the Hollywood ending of this podcast. But I don't think he survived. I don't think we'll ever know who Dan Cooper truly was. I don't think that was his true name, of course. But based on the horrible conditions that he jumped in, the apparent lack of experience, I don't know what that sound was. That just scared the willies out of me. I don't know if you heard that on the podcast, but something just... Okay, got the shivers from that one. Moving on. Based on all of the things. Parachute had no way to steer. He jumped into an unforgiving area with no opening for a landing zone. I don't think he survived. I think he probably hit something on the way down, got taken out by a tree, hit the ground going too fast, and was killed on impact. But we'll never know. I don't think we'll ever know. Unless they find a body somewhere in the woods that they can fully identify with DNA or dental records or fingerprints. Well, not fingerprints anymore, but it's just always going to be a mystery. What I do know is that I learned during this research, you have to be careful looking into this case because people take a little bit of information from sources and they sensationalize it, and it's hard to tell what's true and what's not. So if you look more into this, be careful about what sources you trust. Even the documentary I watched, you know, a documentary film crew that puts together all this information, and you want to be able to trust these documentaries that put out, you know, an hour and a half worth of information that seems to be well-researched. Crucial information is left out, particularly the DNA evidence. But they say someday all your questions will be answered. I hope that's true, because I want to know who D.B. Cooper was. Until next time, that's all I got for you today. Check back next month. It is the final month of the first year of the Curiosity Chronicles. 2021 is coming to an end. December will be a full year of podcast episodes. I'm thankful that I continue to be able to put this out, and it's listeners and seeing people checking in and listening and mentioning it to me that really keeps me going, keeps me motivated. So please continue to reach out. I really appreciate it. Please keep listening. I love doing it, and I'll be happy to bring hopefully many more years worth of podcasts. But for the time being, I'm signing off for the night. My name is Brett Bielsma. I am the host of the Curiosity Chronicles, and until next time, I hope that you stay curious.